are listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. After a rollercoaster week in UK politics, the government has seen off a raft of House of Lords changes to key Brexit legislation. But what happens next, and what further challenges remain for Theresa May's government? I'm Madeline Grant, Digital Officer at the IEA, and joining me today are members of the IEA's International Trade and Competition Unit, Senior Counsel Victoria Hewson, and Senior Research Analyst Dr. Radomir Talcoat. We take a look at what this all means for Brexit, and how the ongoing debates have revealed new fault lines and new fissures in British politics and wider society. Finally, we examine how politicians of all stripes must improve their expertise on international trade in order to raise the standard of debate and properly scrutinise the government in the months and years ahead. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations. It's been an immensely hectic week in Parliament, but I must admit I've been finding it very difficult to follow along, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this. Could we first briefly go through what exactly has happened this week and what it all means for Brexit?
So this week we've seen the EU withdrawal bill return to the Commons from the Lords to see all the amendments on which the government had been defeated overturned during two heated days of debate. These amendments included the meaningful vote amendment, which would allow the Commons to decide a course of action if Parliament rejects the Brexit deal, to make an exit date subject to parliamentary approval, and making government prioritise being in the EEA and preventing withdrawal unless a customs union continues. One way this was achieved was a new amendment by government, which appears to be unamendable following conversations with both pro-Remain and pro-Leave MPs on Tuesday and Wednesday. And the amendment, this apparent compromise amendment, has been the subject of continuing debate in the press.
The government has seemingly defeated all 15 of the amendments from the House of Lords. Is this the end of it, or is it just the first round? Will we see the House of Lords playing a bigger role further down the line?
This is the big question now as we go into next week, where it goes back to the Lords. Rad has already mentioned the proposed compromise amendment on a meaningful vote, which we can be reasonably hopeful that that's done enough to satisfy the Conservative rebels in the House of Commons. But whether the House of Lords will hold their ground and reinsert their original amendment, which, as Rad has said, gave them essentially the right to reject a deal that the government brings back from the Article 50 negotiations, or alternatively, and potentially most damagingly of all for the negotiating position of the Prime Minister, to overturn the government's decision to walk away with no deal and direct the government to take certain steps that Parliament would decide. And the reason why that is such a serious issue is that in reality, the steps that Parliament could prescribe for the government could include, and certain peers have been very open and express about that, to essentially revoke Article 50 and stop Brexit entirely, or to simply accept whatever the EU has offered. So that's why there's such a big deal being made about this amendment, which does seem, you know, a little bit tenuous, talking about a meaningful vote, but that's really the substance of it. The government's compromise amendment on this stands, we would hope, a reasonable chance of being accepted, because it does formalise a certain level of scrutiny, a right for Parliament to have a vote on the end deal, but not to then tie the government's hands as to what they then proceed to do.
And I guess it's partly a numbers game when we're looking at the number of Tory rebels in Parliament at the moment. Is there actually a sizeable enough number of Tory rebels to defeat whatever the government proposes at the moment?
Well, this is where it gets really interesting, because the amendments that were debated last week, the votes went in some very interesting directions. As Rado says, the government successfully overturned all of the amendments, including the ones about seeking to join the European Economic Area, which was a Lords amendment, and also the Labour Party's amendment, which was, I guess, their effort at a compromise position around that, which was to seek full access to the single market and shared rules and institutions. Now, the government overturned both of those, but what was really interesting was the rebellions from the Labour Party side, where basically some rebelled and voted with the government, and some rebelled by voting against the Labour Party.
So we can kind of take heart from the comfortable margins with which the government won these votes.
I think we can take some heart from that. I think the most interesting dynamic we have here from the point of view of those of us who are interested in free trade is the dynamic in the British left as it's manifested in Parliament in the Labour Party, where, as Victoria's described, well, there was substantial rebellion on both sides. There was a whip on the EEA amendment which told Labour MPs to abstain, and there were 75 who voted to join the EEA and 15 who voted against the whip, against joining the EEA. That's a very interesting situation, I think, for the Labour Party, and it represents at least those 15 rebels against the EEA. A number of people on the left, or a number of parliamentarians, coming to grips with the fact that they are representatives of people who basically want free trade. Historically, I think this is a very interesting moment, because the Labour Party has existed really in the period, or rather flourished and had power in the period, since the First World War, where Britain has really not been a major protagonist and a major leader for free trade. We lost confidence after the First World War. We ceased to be this unilateral free trader, putting tariffs on nothing. Free trade as an agenda is currently manifested through support for Brexit. I don't think this is a divide that is going to go away for the parliamentary Labour Party in the months and years to come.
I think what's really interesting about those 15, though, is that the Conservative Party whips will be looking at that with a lot of interest, because if they can rely on 15 or so Labour MPs to support their position on leaving the single market, leaving the customs union, that will go a long way to offsetting the damage that could be done by the rebels on their own side, not just in terms of the withdrawal bill, which has been pretty tense, but also the upcoming pieces of legislation, the customs bill and the trade bill, and all of the associated other pieces of legislation that have to go through to get Brexit to work in practice.
Yeah, so it's all very interesting, because this week we also had the PM's first ministerial resignation in the form of Dr. Philip Lee, although his stepping down didn't really have the desired effect. What I found interesting about this was the fact that his constituency actually voted Leave, and yet he claimed to be acting in the interest of his own constituents. But this is actually a much wider problem, given how few MPs came out for Leave, particularly within the Labour Party, compared to the 52% of people that voted for it. You know, would it be an exaggeration to say that we've got certainly a massive disconnect, if not something of a constitutional crisis on our hands?
It remains to be seen whether this is a constitutional crisis, and I think we will know that in about 6 months' time. We certainly have what you've called a disconnect. The disconnect, I mean, it exists in both parties. It's one that perhaps in the Conservative Party, because it's in government, most MPs are coming into line more with their supporters. Conservatives, of course, majority Leave supporting. But still, I must say, in the left, there is the cultural difference between broadly Northern England, South Wales, working class Brexit and free trade supporting voters and the people who represent them. And I think if you look at what George Orwell said about this, he said something that really still resonates in the conflict we're seeing crystallising now. Socialism, theoretically, is confined entirely to the middle classes, where there are what he called youthful snob Bolsheviks, whose social positions they have no intention of forfeiting. Among this group, there were, quote, every fruit juice drinker, nudist, sandal wearer, sex maniac, Quaker, nature cure quack, pacifist and feminist in England, unquote. I think really, when we look at, what can we call it, metropolitan leftism, it's become so far removed in its dislike of freedom from a huge number of the people it represents. And this is just one example of what you described as the disconnect.
You could see it also in the assaults on lifestyle freedoms, the
Absolutely.
Minimum alcohol pricing and other things that they know perfectly well will clobber the poor, but nevertheless,
they need to be told what's best for them.
Precisely, it's deeply paternalistic.
And this is another example of that, that's exactly it.
And it's also a type of paternalism that people would once have attributed more to the Conservative Party, which obviously is engaging in this as well. But the Labour Party is, if anything, beating the paternalist Tories at their own game.
Yeah, although I think it is important to say that there are, within the Parliamentary Labour Party, clearly people who get this problem. We've seen tremendous noises on free trade being made by Graham Stringer just in this last fortnight.
John Mann.
And there are also former Remain-backing Labour MPs such as Caroline Flint, who represents the Don Valley, Kevin Jones, North Durham, And most recently, a front bench resignation from Laura Smith, whose Leave voting constituency is Crewe and Nantwich. There are definitely those in the parliamentary Labour Party who understand what's going on.
I would slightly hesitate to nominate all of those as ringing endorsements of free trade. I think supporting Brexit in many ways for those voters is about supporting democracy, and then whether or not free trade wins is down to the battle of ideas in this country. But however, the upshot of the Brexit process will hopefully be freer trade. The resignation of Laura Smith is extremely interesting. The battle in the House last week between Caroline Flint and Anna Soubry was quite stunning, actually. And the reversal of those positions between Soubry sort of being bossy and controlling and Caroline Flint really standing up for her Leave voting constituents was quite amazing to see.
Yeah, it was extraordinarily unparliamentary language.
Suck it up.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Whatever that means.
Although, you know, so Victoria's absolutely right on that. Although what I'd add is that these constituencies that voted Leave are also the heartland of the campaign against the Corn Laws, Chartism.
Do not tax the people's bread was the
absolutely.
Slogan.
Absolutely. They are really, you know, for at least a couple of hundred years, this has been the heartland of reform that is now represented by MPs on the left who I think one could say are anti-reformist, and that's an interesting fissure in our politics.
Been watching Poldark recently. I don't know if anyone else has.
Only for, you know, only for research into customs practices.
But of course, yeah. But I think the Corn Laws is going to be a big topic of this coming season. And it's interesting to me that this is happening in rural Cornwall in the 18th century or whatever it is. People were so bemused at Cornwall for voting Leave. They couldn't understand why people might not want to live in a perpetual state of subsidy and servitude. Clearly, we haven't really learnt much from the lessons of the past.
Yeah, I mean, there's another example of that, and that's farmers. I was hearing before the referendum that farmers would definitely vote to remain because of the subsidy they received, some of them, through the Common Agricultural Policy. But that, I think, is the problem, that the people, the voters, are regarded as, I think, by some part of the political class in this city, minions who will be happy as long as they're subsidised and told what to do, not people with agency who may take exception to being a part of a system like that.
So looking ahead, as we hopefully start negotiating with other countries and groupings like TPP for new independent trade deals, as well as the actual trade agreement with the EU, what should MPs and peers be doing to scrutinise and keep the government accountable in these negotiations?
This is really, I think, for lawyers and constitution watchers, as well as people interested in the UK's future trade arrangements and negotiations. This is possibly the most interesting thing to come out of this process and the discussions around the meaningful vote. Brexiteers have been accused of wanting to give the government a blank cheque to negotiate whatever they like and then push it through Parliament. And that's clearly not the case. I mean, there have been more than 250 hours of debate in Parliament, plus countless hours of grilling of government ministers and experts in committees. So the idea that this is just somehow being pushed through in some shady fashion is clearly not right, but it clearly is happening in a quite unstructured way, which has been fairly unsatisfactory. And what we need to be doing is looking at how other countries manage their negotiation processes as they negotiate free trade agreements and big platform agreements like TPP. Really, our MPs, aside from any process that we agree whereby perhaps we have a process like the EU has where the Commission is given a specific mandate and they have to negotiate within those parameters. Really, for any of that to work in practice, MPs need to massively step up to the plate and actually read some of this stuff and try and understand how trade works, how international agreements work, how the WTO works. The debate that we've been having around the customs union, single market and the European Economic Area and EFTA has been derisory. You have MPs standing up in the Commons or asking questions in the Treasury Committee or similar fora, asking for things that just don't even work. You know, calling for the UK to join EFTA and the EEA and stay in a customs union. That just doesn't work. You can't be in EFTA and a customs union. And for MPs to get on their feet in Parliament and call for these things without clearly having done the smallest bit of research or taken any expert advice. That kind of thing has to stop.
Also, I think all the general kind of horse trading that we saw this week and the last minute deals that were being made, right up to the point of the vote, that doesn't exactly fill people with confidence about the way that the government is handling these negotiations.
When you put all of this in the context, not only of our negotiations with the EU, and we hear gossip from Brussels that EU Commission negotiators and civil servants in Brussels are finding all of this hilarious. They find it a sideshow. You know, we've seen popcorn memes being tweeted out.
Oh God.
Which is fair, because in many ways, this is a domestic thing. We are negotiating with ourselves, and the negotiators in Task Force 50 Barnier's team know that it is pretty much a sideshow, and what will happen will be whatever is negotiated with them, and anything that's agreed in Parliament really can only now weaken the government's position. It's not just the EU side who'll be watching this with interest, it's all of our future trade partners in the WTO and in bilateral agreements who will be getting slightly worried as to the credibility of the UK having a trade policy in the first place in any meaningful way and being able to execute it without slightly amateurish interventions from Parliament along the way. And we've seen, by the way, that, you know, the EU has its problems in this area as well, as we saw with the original agreement of the Canada agreement, the CETA agreement, which was nearly undone by an intervention by the regional parliament of Wallonia, and they managed to patch that up and get it over the line. But then last week we had the Italian government threatening not to ratify it at all. And those kinds of things make the EU's trading partners slightly nervous as to how much resource to throw into negotiating these trade deals if they could be brought down at the very end of it by local vested interests.
Yeah, I'm no trade negotiator, but even I know that attempting to remove the option of no deal from the package of possibilities is terrible for our negotiating position. You need to have that threat. You can't just do everything with carrot. You also need the possibility of stick as well.
It's also worth mentioning that although what's happened in Parliament in the last week in particular is very interesting, there are still, I think, 7 bits of legislation needed before exit day, including the trade bill and the customs bill, which are going to, we hope, allow the UK to strike independent trade deals and then allow new customs arrangements. But amendments to these, were they to remain, are liable to in effect keep us in the single market. So what we've seen in Parliament in the last week, hold on to your hats, because it's going to keep happening for some time.
Thank you both.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website, iea.org.uk.